From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 407, recorded live Thursday, January 16th, 2014. This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Zed Shaw about learning to code the hard way.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm talking with Zed Shaw. He's the author of the Mongrel Web Server and most recently the creator of the Learn to Code the Hard Way series. You can learn C, Python, Ruby, regex, SQL, command line interfaces, and lots more. Thanks for talking to me today, Zed.
Yeah, not a problem.
You're a bit of a legend from an opinionated perspective. You have opinions that are very, very strong, and I feel like the Learn to Code the Hard Way is such an embodiment of your opinion. You know what I mean? It's just kind of a, like, just suck it up and let's get to the hard stuff. I really like that. Like, where does that come from inside you?
Yeah, I would say that's actually true. I'd say that for the most part, I don't know. I guess it's just from my background. I mean, I was in the army. I've always just been told that the way to learn stuff is to sit down and actually power through it and learn it and, you know, and actually do it. And there's not really any shortcuts. And actually, that's one of the things I try to show people is that the joy of learning something is struggling with it and conquering it and kind of getting through it, and that it's not supposed to be easy. Like, if it's easy, then what's the point, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think in a lot of ways, the way I teach sort of reflects that, although I have to sort of like demilitarize it for people. But I would say probably the biggest influence would be military experience, martial arts, things like that. And that's why it's like that.
So those are all very things that emphasize discipline. Do you think that discipline is something that's like kind of sadly lacking from our industry?
I think discipline is just sadly lacking from education in general. I think, especially in American education systems, I think it got a bad rap. It's associated with the negative kind of discipline, like corporal punishment, rote memorization. But I also think at some point it got sort of like attributed to a lack of creativity by a bunch of people who really kind of don't know how creativity is done. Mm-hmm. So I think I think kids these days aren't taught discipline. I think they aren't taught self-discipline, which is the key. And that's actually just kind of pervasive now. I'm not sure why. I have some theories. I think the rise of constructivism in education and education departments, all sorts of things. But in general, yeah, I think discipline's missing and needed.
It seems a little bit to me, and I'm raising, you know, two little boys. I have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old, that their expectation of how long it takes to learn something relates directly to how long it takes to find something out. So I'll ask a question and like, you know, why is the sky blue? And when I was a kid, we would go and we'd get the Encyclopedia Britannica. And, you know, we'd go and get, you know, the volume number 19 and look it up and try to figure that out. While my 6-year-old's like, well, we should Google that. So like even acquiring basic bits of facts and stuff is too easy almost. Like there's no challenge. Maybe there should maybe when you Google for something, there should be like a challenge that you have to accomplish first, a barrier.
You have to do 10 pushups.
Yeah. Do something. Yeah. 10 pushups. Make sure that the Kinect sees you do the pushups, and then we will allow you to unlock the secrets of why the sky is blue. So from that perspective, they're not interested in putting in the work it takes to become good at something, it seems.
Yeah, I think actually programmers are very guilty of this too. Like they have this tendency to, once they read about a thing, they assume they know it and can do it. Mm-hmm. And they don't ever take that next step of, oh, and now I'm going to actually do a bunch of these things. So they might read about music and then say, I can play an instrument. And you're like, no, you don't know anything about music. You actually have to practice. It's hard. And I think that's the key is, if it's just arbitrary facts and things you can look up, yeah. There's no point in memorizing that. But there are a set of skills and a set of things that people want to do and learn how to do and be good at that require practice and repetition and application. And I don't think you get that in like, especially the internet culture, programmer culture, things like that.
Yeah.
And it's the direct, like people are just used to getting stuff right away. They assume that tidbit of info I got from Google is, you know, I mean, that was so quick. And now what you get is, they don't want to invest the time in learning it and going through the struggle.
Yeah, I'm working on an iOS app right now with a web component that's going to involve pairing, you know, kind of like pairing mm-hmm. this app to this website so that they all talk to each other. And mm-hmm. The discussions that I'm having with my partner are basically like, oh no, that extra click could mean 10% of our users are going to leave at that point. Like if they can't download it and within 2 minutes or three clicks, and we just like made those numbers up, you know, they're going to abandon mm-hmm. it completely. And we're just like, really? It's an amazing app. And you're mm-hmm. saying that there's all these UX mistakes that we could potentially make. And he's imagining like 100% of people show up. They have to do this. Boom. Okay. You've lost half of them. You know, I'm like, really? Really? They downloaded it. We lost half of them. They want to do it. We have such mm-hmm. low expectations of our users. We're just like, yeah, they're not going to be interested in, you know, clicking. It's such a banal thing. So we're actually going to be using QR codes. And I know that. The answer to should you use a QR code is always no. But basically, it's like, okay, they can either see this GUID and type this GUID, or they could, you know, what's the easiest way we could get this GUID into this device? And it's just like, gosh, I feel like the onboarding process is completely overshadowing the awesomeness on the other side. And I feel the same way about programming. Like, we're focused so much on onboarding people into development, and they're completely missing, mm-hmm. Why am I doing this?
Yeah, I also think there's a slightly odd American cultural component where for the longest time, like people who are nerds and geeks and programmers were sort of like assumed to kind of not be doing anything important, right? Like it was like a hobby. Like a lot of people just got paid to do their hobby. That's how I looked at it.
Mm.
And it's only really recently that people are like, oh, wow, you can actually be filthy rich if you do this and you become Mark Zuckerberg or whatever. And so there's this huge cultural debt, I guess you would call it,
mm-hmm.
of people used to think being a programmer was just, oh, well, that's easy. But nobody really bothered to figure out how to do it and whether it was easy. They just thought you were just like some strange little nerd who liked to work with a computer. So obviously that must be easy. And now people are into it and they're sort of realizing that, oh, it's way more difficult than that. It takes you years to be good at it. And that's probably a big reason why you're seeing this. Like you're seeing people come to programming from a background of not understanding it at all, but also sort of like a general loathing of nerd culture within large sections of society. And they come to it and then they go, oh, well, this is actually more difficult than I thought it was. And I mean, I'm sort of waiting for it to be I'm hoping my books give people some respect for what I do. I think that's a big part of it. But you might actually you do see some backlash. You see people who are like, oh, why should my kids learn how to be nerds? That's so stupid. And I think that's like one of the negative things you try to fight.
Yeah, when I was coming up, being a nerd was a bad thing. And I don't understand why that is. I mean, being smart should not be looked down upon. I saw in a newspaper today that Neil deGrasse Tyson is bringing back the Cosmos series. He's going to bring mm-hmm. back Cosmos that Carl Sagan did because he said that being smart and knowing these things is somehow looked down upon. He wants to try to make it fun again. When you were thinking about which was the first one? What was the first learn to code the hard way? It was Python, right?
Yeah, it was Python. And I had actually written that for a friend who wanted to learn, and she couldn't find any other books. So I just sort of like started hacking on it while I was watching TV pretty much.
Well, but why learn the hard way? Why not learn Python in 24 hours? Surely there must have been a book like that for your friend.
Yeah, and that was the thing, is she tried those, and, you know, I actually probably could think that if someone wanted to spend a whole 24 hours and sit down and, like, do it for 24 hours straight, they might be able to get through a large portion of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, like, sap your intelligence and your brain just stops working, so I don't know how useful it is. Mm-hmm. But I think it's actually just, it's more like how the subjects were taught by all these other books didn't work for very beginners. So I think books were either written for little kids, and so they were kind of useless,
mm-hmm.
or they were written for adult programmers. Even if they said it was for beginners, they were totally written for a programmer. And they just assumed tons of information that you just wouldn't have. And so because I had a specific person in mind while I was writing it, and I sort of had experience from, I had just completed a music school. So I had suffered through trying to learn to play guitar at like, you know, my late 30s. So I knew a lot about how adult learning was like, what would work. And mm-hmm. I was just like, I'm like, yeah, you know, what you need to do is you need to have it like the bare minimums to start, and you need to just do a lot of practice until you can get up until these words don't seem so weird. Mm-hmm. In the same way that you need to want to play guitar, you got to do the same thing, you know. And that was the primary difference. It was just that I thought, as an adult learner, it doesn't come quickly to you. Languages don't come quick to you. So rote sort of practice and then applying it is a better way. And it turned out to be right.
And do you think that that means that one should be an adult? I mean, should I stick a 12-year-old on Learn Python the Hard Way? Or, I mean, what age is appropriate?
Well, a lot of the theory behind it later, I sort of backed into the theory, was based on the direct instruction school of teaching. And I think what happened is because I had written it for an adult mm-hmm. who was trying to learn it and was busy, say, right?
Right.
I think that made it easy enough that just about anybody can go through it. So the people who don't even read English very well go through it. Kids go through it. Just about everyone does. It's sort of like I set my bar of the learner so low, no offense to my friend, but I set the bar super low. And so that meant that a lot of other people could actually finish it. And then also, I think it fits well with kids from what I've seen because it's very tiny chunks. So it's hard for them to get distracted by it or to, you know, to get overwhelmed by it. It's like teeny tiny little chunks. You can do them in like a little hour, mm-hmm. Which I think seems to work better when you're, you know, when you're younger. But also if you're in a busy adult, too.
Mm-hmm. But now direct instruction as a concept is something that's not new. It came up in the 60s, actually the University of Oregon. And mm-hmm. its characteristic is this idea that there's systematic scripted lesson plans. You go boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. That is that the discipline? And how is that different than what you use the word rote learning? How do you describe your technique and the kind of idea behind direct instruction versus just what they call rote learning?
Yeah, I think the thing with direct instruction is that they're more using these scripts to make sure that things are taught consistently. And included in direct instruction is also application of it, and they also have very solid statistics and analysis that show like, well, this doesn't work for later learning, you know, like it doesn't work as well when you're trying to teach creative art, but it would work well if you're trying to teach how to draw circles, right? So applying math to solving physics problems, this doesn't work, but learning the basics of algebra or the basics of trigonometry, this totally works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have a similar approach within my book in that I tell people if you're a programmer, like in the very beginning, this book will drive you nuts. Like it's so annoying.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, if you're a programmer, this is like this just the worst way to learn a programming language. But if you're not a programmer, that slow, methodical, scripted way of applying it and doing the proper exercises mm-hmm. Works better. That's also why my book sort of stops at the point when you would go and get creative. Because it doesn't really work. The rote kind of repetition doesn't really help you in creative activities, mm-hmm. right? It just helps you learn the tools you need to then apply them.
Yeah, it felt like I've done both the Python one and the C one. And, mm-hmm. and it felt like when it kind of ended and I was like, and where's part two? Like it kind of left me like, oh, I could do input. I could do a basic game. Where's the mm-hmm. larger architectural context? And I was like, oh, well, that wasn't the point now, was it? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, it's mostly, I tell people, like, it gives you your brown belt. Like, it teaches you all the kicks and the punches, and you know the stuff, but now you got to go work and use it to get your black belt, right? And then I point people at loads of other resources for doing that. Because, honestly, what I see with all the other books out there, I mean, I don't want to say all of them, but most of the other books, they start at where my book ends.
Mm-hmm.
So they assume, even if they're trying not to, that you already kind of know programming.
Right.
And my book is like, okay, I'm going to get you to a point where you can go through some other book. And so that's what I do. And then I shove people off over to Django or SciPy or any of these other projects that have books they can read.
Right, right. I actually, as someone who was a professional C programmer 20 years ago, I did still find the Learn C the Hard Way kind of a nice refresher. Because it was mm-hmm. like, okay, well, here's the state of the tools right now. And here's what you're going to need on a Mac or on Windows or on Linux. And I was like, oh, yeah. Well, that's, I forgot about, you know, the way that worked. Cause it, mm-hmm, I haven't been a programmer for, I haven't been a C programmer for, gosh, 95 was the last time I really wrote any significant C. So mm-hmm. it seemed like it did fill in some of the pieces. There were certain kind of Tetris pieces that fell into like the parts of my brain that I'd written over. And I was like, oh, wow, I totally forgot about that.
Right. Yeah. And that book actually was targeted at, scripting programmers who don't really know C, but it's so helpful for them to know it. Because, I mean, extending their languages depend on it. Even just simple things like how programs crash, how security bugs work, all of that stuff works is just way easier to understand if you know C. And what I found is you had a bunch of people who knew Ruby and Python and these other languages that were kind of like, they had imposter syndrome because they didn't really know how a computer worked and they didn't really know how memory management worked and how pointer worked. And so my book is targeted at that. And, and also just because C is fun. I mean, it's fun and cool and you can break things.
Well, C, C is like, it's an accessible kind of assembler. Where it's like you're in the beast, you know, you're deep in there, and it's gonna, when it crashes spectacularly because it's clearly your fault. It's never the computer's fault when it's in C.
Exactly. and also that's like an important lesson that I think people learn from the book. I think too many programmers don't get past that stage of blaming the computer. You know, like they don't take on the, I guess it's kind of like, you know, when you learn, when you, again, a martial art, you learn a martial art, you start to realize, oh, I can die doing this stuff, you know? So when they learn C, they're like, oh man, you could really hose a computer with this stuff, you know? And it's like, with scripting languages, they don't get that, you know?
So when did this start becoming the kind of like the Khan Academy of code? I remember that it seemed like the Learn Python was almost a piece of charity that you put out there for all of us. And it was like, wow, you know, Zed's this great humanitarian. He's given us this book of work. And then a year and a half comes by. I go back up. Now there's a whole series of books and there's Kindle and there's videos and there's commentary. When did this happen?
I would say about 2 years ago. Well, so what had happened is I wrote the book, got it as a PDF on my website, just kind of put it up there. And I think I was up to like exercise 34 and I was kind of like unclear on how I wanted to do it. And I have this weird working habit with books where I get to a point and I go, and I sort of let it simmer, sometimes way too long. And then I come back to it in like a flash of insight and I sort of like finish it off or I revamp it. But I think it sat up there for a year. And then I went back and pulled down the download statistics for it off of my web server for the PDF. And I found out like in that 1 year, 350,000 downloads had been made of this one PDF. And I was like, oh, wow. Maybe this shouldn't be a PDF and maybe I should actually like, you know, charge a little something for it. And I still wanted it to really be online for free because, I mean, it was just, I felt for me, it was like, I wanted other people to understand me, right? Like I wanted other people to understand programmers and what computers were doing. And I felt like they were getting kind of like bowled over by computing technology. But if they learned at least the basics of programming, they would survive better within this world that's suddenly like just overlapping them with computers. And so I just kept it up there. And, then I threw on, you know, hey, you can buy a PDF, you can buy, videos and put them on a course website. And then, eventually, I was getting enough purchases that I was making more money from just that one book than I was from my job. So I was like, well, all right, I'm just going to quit my job and work on this book. And then I just wrote the next one and the next one, got stalled, sort of stopped, started making a website to sell it a little better. And that's where it's been. I mean, I think it's been that way for about 2 years now. Two and a half.
And this is effectively your full-time gig now, or are you doing other work?
It's my full-time gig. And so what I do is, that book funds, me working on other subjects that I plan on teaching to people. And I'm sort of trying to be, kind of like a translator between the programmer slash geek world and the rest of the world and back and forth. So, cause I have a really weird, diverse set of interests. So what I'm planning on doing, what I've been doing for the last year and why I've sort of been maybe a little quiet is I've been learning subjects well enough that I feel like I could teach them or at least corral a couple other experts to help me teach them. And sort of teach them to programmers or programming topics to regular people, so on and so forth. And that's pretty much all I've been doing. I've got those five books I got to finish, never get around to finishing them. And I do the videos and then I have other books in the works that I'm sort of tinkering with. And then in the spare time, I write fiction and I paint now and just all sorts of random stuff.
Wow. That's pretty slick. What do you think about the, things like the Khan Academy's computer science section and Codecademy and things like that? I mean, do you think that there would be some merging of you and these other things, or do you like the independence that doing this on your own offers you?
I sort of feel like I like the independence of it. And I've been approached by, I think, just about every Learn to Code site out there. And apart from the fact that they just don't know how to structure a deal, I mean, I don't get it. You know, it's like they want it for free. It's like, that's not how it works. So, you have to, I mean, I have to eat, you know? But I think what happens is because I'm not really, there's no investors for me. I make enough to survive and live, you know, reasonably comfortably. I'm not, you know, wealthy by any means at all. Mm-hmm. But because I really have no masters, I can sort of like just write for people and write what is going to help them out, what I'm interested in, what they do. Mm-hmm. And that freedom is really priceless. I mean, at times I feel like maybe having a gig would give me things to write about. But when it comes down to actually producing educational material and writing these books, yeah, being a free agent, I think, gives me way more freedom to kind of do it the way I see works and the way that I'm good at, and also sort of lets me keep my personality. Mm-hmm. I think that's the big thing. Because when you start working for other people, for whatever reason, they don't want to have your personality too. And I think my personality is a big part of my writing.
Mm. Well, how do you then combine your personality, your style, your preferences in the writing, and that you have some of these books like the Regex book up on GitHub and you encourage people to make changes? And how does that work? Is it open source or not? What do you own? What do we, the public, own? Can you explain that?
Yeah, for the most part, I've had to start taking those books down because, in a lot of ways, like I keep the Regex and the SQL book up because it's not really, available yet. But when I have the other books up, I've had people come in and rip the code out, put their favorite language in, and then declare themselves the author of my book.
Ouch.
Yeah, and the code is not the hard part. Like, it's how you structure the exercises and actually what's written. That's the hard part. And you could slot in code and it may not work, you know? Mm. So I've had to take the books down from GitHub and things, the Python and the Ruby and all that, and sort of like say, yeah, I'm just putting up for free. It's not editable anymore. Because I don't mind receiving edits and stuff like that. People send me the email edits, but mm-hmm. when it was up, people assumed, oh, if it's up on like Gatorius or something like that, obviously it's totally free and I can just, you know, steal this guy's work.
Right.
And then they get all super offended when you tell them you can't. It's like, yeah, you can't do that.
But I pushed clone. That made it mine though, right?
Yeah. It's like, I am very into the free exchange of ideas that open source gives people, but there's a lack of respect for creators, I think. And I think they just assume that the stuff is free. It's like, yeah. Roads, right? And it's like, no, there's some dude made that. Yeah. Give him some respect.
Yeah. As someone who's been blogging for now 12 years, a couple of weeks ago, I started seeing another site showing up ahead of me in Google, and it made me very, mm-hmm. very frustrated. And basically, mm-hmm. a very nice gentleman in China had completely cloned my entire site. It was a complete copy. You know what I mean? It was like a parallel mm-hmm. universe version of me with like a goatee and an evil attitude. And I was like, wow, Evil Scott is a total jerk. And he ripped my ads out and he was running his own ads. And the part that blew me away was that he didn't see a problem with it. Like,
yeah,
there was like, I made this though. I put a lot of work into it. And he's like, well, I put a lot of work into this site as well. I'm like, well, by definition, not nearly as much.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because if you did that to them, they would be livid.
Oh, of course they would. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things that you've done that I think is really nice, though, that I find to be quite a clever compromise, and I'm not sure if this is still being actively done, but you've actually created a construction kit so that I could make my own something the hard way. You've basically given us a construction kit that is, it looks like a series of Rust files and LaTeX that just says, all right, here's the structure that I use to make the book. You go and make a learn foo yourself with my build system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the method is really straightforward. I mean, I'm basically just ripping off guitar method books. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard. It's right. Like you set up a bunch of exercises, you're done. So I just wanted to make the barrier to entry so small for someone who has a programming language to make their own book. And mm-hmm. it's like, look, you just come up with 52 exercises, start people with the bare minimum, and by the end, figure out what your goal is, who you're talking to, that you're done. But it was more of a compromise. It was kind of like, well, instead of stealing my book and being lazy, I want you to write your own book, but I know this is kind of like hard to figure out. Like, digital publishing is a pain.
Right.
So here's a template that just makes all the crap for you. Like, it just, everything works. Mm-hmm. Although I do have to update it. I got some stuff to do. But yeah, that was the idea. It was a compromise. It was like, grab this, do what you want. Mm-hmm. Now, programmers being programmers, of course, they can't just use what someone else gave them. So they all go make their own thing and then they have their own layouts and they sort of don't get the concept. But the idea is there. You know, you can write your own.
Have you seen anything helpful come out of that? I know that a lot of people put things out online and they seem like a great idea, but has anyone made a learn foo that you've been impressed with that we should take a look at?
Yeah, there's a few of them, and actually I've been wanting to collect them together. I know there was Steve Loesch did a Learn Vim the Hard Way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not particularly structured my way because he is targeting programmers, so my style would annoy them, but the same concept is there where you go through and you do exercises and you figure out how to use Vim.
Mm-hmm.
There's another gentleman, Graham, who's working on Learn Java the Hard Way.
Mm-hmm.
And his book is good. He's still working on it, but I believe he teaches this to high school students.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a good target audience to, like, you know, aim that kind of book at.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going through it all by himself too. And but I haven't really seen many other books. I know there's a few here and there. They might use the title, but they don't necessarily use the same structure. And also I think, there could be some languages that would really benefit from this kind of book. Like, you know, I would love to see one on Clojure or Lisp
mm-hmm.
that was structured the way mine is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also really like to see one on, Rust, I think is a language that's looking pretty interesting. I'd like to see one on that.
It definitely seems to be a language that's coming up mm-hmm. quite quickly.
Yeah, I like the fact that they're focusing on systems and it's compiled and it has the same expressiveness as a dynamic. So
mm-hmm.
we'll see how that goes. But again, I think there's big problems with the way a lot of these people write their books for their programming language, which is understandable because they're busy writing a programming language.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they really skimp on is install. I think for beginners, the biggest thing is install. Like if you can't get someone to install it, they're just not going to bother. And I think that universally applies to just about everybody, every programming language and every programmer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like in mine, you notice I've got like a really extensive install at the beginning of the Python book, and
mm-hmm.
I had to strip down the tools to make it like it's just a text editor,
right.
Your shell, and Python.
I've had actually conversations with folks at Microsoft where I work, where I say that, you know, there's lots of reasons that Node has done really well. You know, the fact that it's JavaScript, it's not a particularly amazing way to do things. It's quite confusing and the threading model is a mess and all that kind of stuff. But if you could put your finger on one thing, it's the fact that you make a text file and you type Node and it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to explain that to some of the folks at Microsoft who was like, you know, when you put that up against something that's like, okay, well, download this one thing. It's only a gig. Mount this ISO and then reboot twice. You know,
and then
you wonder, like, well, why isn't anyone using this?
And it's sort of like what you were saying. Like, I remember back in the day, I would spend weeks just to get something to work because
mm-hmm.
that was fun,
right.
You know? And I was like, oh, yeah. Now I'm kind of like, wait, this takes longer than 5 seconds? Nah, never mind.
Yeah, if I can't NPM install pretty much anything, you know what I mean? Like, I was telling my boss, we should make it so we could NPM install ASP.NET. And if it worked and then you could just type it, people would probably use it.
yeah. And it's totally true, man. If like they can sit there from the command line and just like, you know, I mean, PowerShell is awesome, right? You imagine if you could just PowerShell install like commandlets, that would just be the bomb.
Yeah, actually, funny story. You can now. It's called psget and it's just install. Yeah. It's called psget. And there's a great, you know, you'll love this.
Mm-hmm.
PS readline. It's up on GitHub.
Oh,
it's nice. It's a GNU implementation of readline for PowerShell and it's fantastic.
Great. Yeah, I'm very impressed with PowerShell. I mean, you know, like, I'm pretty agnostic. Like, if tools are good, tools are good, you know? And I think that's also one of the reasons why, I like being a free agent in my teaching because, there's a lot of people who use their teaching as sort of an indoctrination propaganda technique. And I'm much more into, I'm just teaching people to be independent and do user stuff.
Yeah.
And so, so when I was writing the command line crash course book and I'm trying to find the PowerShells.
Mm-hmm.
I try to find the
commandlets,
the PowerShell. Yeah, no, the analogs between Linux, Unix, and PowerShell. There's like about 14 commands that are super similar, like CP and
the
LS.
Aliases. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what I did is I was like going through it, and I'm like, man, PowerShell's kind of awesome. I was like reading about commandlets, and I'm like, wait, you can write .NET assemblies and plug them in and get commands? Wow, you know, it's just like this is great.
You know, I don't wonder there should be a learn PowerShell the hard way. Is the concept of the hard way something that you have trademarked? I mean, you said that there's someone who has learned Vim and learned Vim script the hard way. Does that person have to ask your permission, or how does that work?
Nope. So one of the things about titles is it's nearly impossible to kind of trademark them. So I could trademark like a service if I was teaching it,
mm-hmm.
but the title of a book, you can't really trademark the form of a title. If you could, people could just wipe out the entire publishing industry.
Don't you think the Four Dummies people would probably come after you if you called it that?
Yeah, I think they would, but, you know, it's like when they come up with movies that have similar titles, and when they have all sorts of other books that have similar titles, it's just hard for people to go after it. But I think what a lot of people do is they get a service mark. So a service mark is like, I am teaching this thing, I have like a consulting business. So, you know, the Seven Habits guys. And those guys, yeah. So that's why people can say the Seven Habits of Highly Effective Dorks or some, just change one word and they can't be sued for it because you can't really like trademark a title.
Right.
So I don't really do it, but also it just seems like I want this method to be a little more accessible, and I'm not going to go around like, you know, chasing some guy down if he's helping people learn his programming language or his favorite programming language. So I sort of let people just use it and, I don't even bother. And also like, I don't have enough money for lawyers and all that crap. I mean, yeah. I can't even like register the trademark, you know? So
one of the last things that I wanted to ask you was this idea of the historical context. The older I get, not only do I kind of get that old man strength, but I also get a sense of like, you kids don't understand how hard it was in the past. So when I go and teach at the local university, I do the exploring engineering class where it's just like, I usually sit down and I want to teach them about like the IBM Selectric typewriter and all this kind of stuff. And half the kids' eyes glaze over and the other half, you know, are asleep. I talked to Douglas Crockford and he said that we're not, you know, teaching this stuff enough. We're not teaching kids about why it's that way and the history of CRLF. Where do those things fit in a very practical world like learning to code the hard way?
Yeah, I think, you know, partially a lot of those historical things were because of just odd sort of like problems with technology in the past. So I think there's some stuff that people just like, ugh, okay, there's no reason why anyone should have done that. If anything, I would consider that kind of like a cool anthropology course, like the study of how humans basically screw up technology with like bad decisions and then we're cursed with them forever, you know? So, but as far as like, I think the biggest thing about like teaching technology that you don't get from a lot of educators now is they're not making people make stuff, you know? Like if you go get a degree or let's say you learn carpentry or art or any other activity where there's a creative result where you're making a thing, you make things. Like they have you make things. If you're in a class in carpentry now and you don't make a thing, you're not really taking a good class. And I think what we get with programming is way more lecture and not enough actually building stuff. So if I were to teach the history of programming, I would actually teach people how to make these crappy computers we had back then. And I would, or like how they would build them in software or like, well, hey, what if you're going to do this? Okay. Well, what are you going to do that? And like actually build up these things and show them that, oh, the problem existed because of these things by having them actually make stuff.
That is a really good idea. I don't know anything about music. I know that you're a musician, but I can only assume that there's quite a big difference between music theory and music class. And music theory, you expect to be sitting in a lecture and thinking about things like that. But most music classes, I assume, have an instrument in your hands.
Yeah, it's actually true. Even in music theory, you're using your voice. At least someone has a piano. They have, in the music schools I've been to, you have to do a performance on a regular basis, or you have like an ensemble class you take, or you compose things. I think in all the music theory classes I've had, composition classes, we compose things. And also you're learning, if you're learning to play songs, you actually play them and you're graded on how well you play them. I think too often in the programming classes, they have you do things that are sort of like very arbitrary, kind of dumb exercises that don't really, have any impact and you don't really make stuff. And that's fine in the very low level beginners, kind of like where my book's at. Like you're not making anything useful in my book, but in the more advanced creative stuff, yeah, you should be building. You should be building lots, like over and over.
That's very cool. I'm going to put in the show notes a link to, of course, learncodethehardway.org. People can certainly go and Google for Zed Shaw and find you. And there's also at amazon.com/Zed-Shaw, there's all the books you can see. All that will be in the show notes as well. And be sure to explore his site, because while the books are available online in HTML, you can get them as PDFs, you can get them in Kindle format, but you also get videos. So you've got a video per exercise as well that you've done in your studio at home.
Yep, that's true. Yeah. And yeah, I spent a long time building a do-it-yourself vocal booth out of a garden shed. So hopefully the videos are good.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Yep. Thank you very much. This was fun.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.